Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. For fabulous ideas and great savings, the winter sale is not to be missed. Now on, in-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. We often talk about the cost of living here on Liveline. Yesterday we were referring to the, as you know, taxi fares went up dramatically just before Christmas, thanks to the National Transport Authority. And we heard yesterday of a fare from Harold's Cross in Dublin to Dublin Airport of €70. One person, €70 in a taxi. And people are again using the phrase rip-off Republic. And then before Christmas, we came across RIP off Republic when the Irish Times, who when they bought RIP.ie last February, thanks to an immediate question from an astute Liveline listener, we asked them, have you any plans to charge for RIP? And they said, absolutely not. Well, they, as you know now, not just the cost of living that's gone up, it's the cost of dying that's gone up, because now it's £100. You pay it. The undertaker won't pay it. He'll pay it on your behalf and then bill you. That's gone up. Now, another thing that was pointed out today is that the Beano, the comic, is it the only surviving comic in these islands that we all grew up with? The Beano, the Hotspur, the Jackie, the Victor, the Sparky, and the Dandy, and all those characters. The Beano, a man bought a Beano in a Dublin shop yesterday and paid, wait for it, it's €3.25 in the UK, €3.25 in the UK. But by the time it got to Dublin, rip off Dublin, it turned into €5, €3.25 sterling in the UK. It's €5.90 in Dublin. Now, Galway news agent has been on to say, okay, it is €3.25 sterling in Galway, which I thought was further from the UK than Dublin. In Galway, the Beano will cost you €4.85, which is €1 cheaper than you'll pay in Dublin. But anyway, so it brought us into the whole issue of comics earlier on, and who still collects comics, and how much should you spend on them. And Simon Qualter contacted us. Simon is also in Galway. Simon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. For how long did you collect comics? First of all, remind the younger generation of the type of comic that you collected, Simon.
Well, Joe, I just heard the Beano been mentioned there, and it brought me back to the, you know, the early days of the 80s when I was a kid. Like, I would have started off with the Beano and the Dandy, but, you know, I found my way into Roy the Rovers then after that, about 1987, I'd say.
Okay.
And I collected that every single week until probably 1991.
Wow.
And I spoke to your researcher there, and I have them, most of them, probably 80% of them, in chronological order.
Wow, well
in
done.
Absolute pristine condition. So I pulled out two of them there, just the first two random ones I got from the 3rd of September 1988. We've got one of them, and you're on about prices, Joe. This one cost 44 pence.
Pence, yeah.
In T&M Mackens in Oranmore, which is a local news agent back in the day. Yeah.
At 44 so, pence, I'm trying to work out, I think it's about 10
cents. We cost 30 pence in the UK, so there's like a 14p difference.
Yeah. And how many do you reckon you have, Simon?
Well, I went up there and I've got like two boxes of them, so I suppose I've got a couple of hundred of them, I'd say.
And do you want to get, are you going to keep them? Like, are your children interested? And they were weekly stories. Each comic had about 12 or 13 different characters, so to speak, or groups of characters. And there was a storyline every week, and it was a folly or upgrade. Each storyline always ended on with the cartoon.
The cliffhanger.
Always ended with a cliffhanger, so you'd buy the comic the next week, which a lot of people did. Apparently, at its height, The Beano in the UK was selling 3 million copies a week. 3 million copies a week, believe. Sorry, I tell a lie. 2 million copies a week in the 1950s. Can you imagine that in print? But Simon, are your children interested in them?
Well, you know, it's funny, Joe. We were upstairs there a couple of days ago, my children, and I was just tidying, going through a few books, and Huckleberry Finn fell out on the floor.
Yeah,
right?
Mark Twain, yeah.
I said to my daughter, I said, listen, look at this book here. I signed it like in 1986. And it just goes to show you like, that it just remained in the house. And then, you know, but I've never mentioned the comics to them because, I mean, they're put away in the attic. And
yeah, I just wonder, is there any museum or any collector that would take them off? Are you willing to part with them if they went to a good home?
I suppose I would be, yeah, because they're no good to me. Like,
Would you want money for them? Would you want money for them, Simon?
I don't know, Georgie.
Yeah, no, fair play. I hear you saying no, but it'd be great to keep them. Just stay there, Simon. Joe at rt.ie 51551. Garrett Palini is in Offaly, Clochran in Offaly. Is the snow affected you, Garrett, by the way, before we start?
Oh, it's pretty chilly out there. We made a snowman.
Oh, you made a snowman? Very good. Okay, but you weren't stranded or without food, I hope. Okay. How many comics do you have, Garrett?
Between 16,000 and 20,000.
What?
Somewhere around there. Yeah. I love my comics. I always have.
16,000? Between 60? And what, you live in the shed and the comics live in your house, do they? Where are they stored?
If my wife had her way, she'd make a separate art house for my comics and myself. I have a comic room. So this has been a passion for over 30 years.
Yeah.
And I've collected everything from Marvel, DC, Archie, Turtles. And it just remained a passion.
And what age were you when you started collecting?
So I was about 5. And I remember my father would take me to the local store. And in the bargain bin, you could get them for the equivalent of 1p. And then I get one a week.
And was this in South? I know you're pointed out in your call. You're from South Africa. The joy of comics or the excitement of the weekly comic? Can you communicate that to a younger smartphone generation, Gareth?
I think there's something about the feel of holding paper in your hands and being able to duck your head under the covers in your bed and shine a flashlight and read them at night when your parents say go to bed. But fond memories, I think it does hold that nostalgia.
And there were cartoons and they were, I know they were black and white, but they were, well, the cover was colour and then they did go full colour. But like, I remember the Victor and the Second World. Remember, comics started shortly, 5 years after the Second World War, effectively. Comics began, and they were a way of entertaining. The cartoons, the drawings were absolutely brilliant. The explosions and the German armored cars, and then you had Alf Tupper on the track in his bare feet with his fish supper. And what was your favorite comic, Gareth? Now, did you have one? I don't mean to put you on the spot. Like, who was your favorite child?
I think Spider-Man. As a kid, I loved Spider-Man. Okay. So I was influenced by the American comics slightly more than the UK comics.
And describe this comic room. Are they in boxes? Are they, they're hard to stack, aren't they, on the shelf because of their primarily paper, but...
I'm quite OCD. Everything goes into a bag, into a plastic comic sleeve with a backing board, and then it's sealed with a special tape and they go into special comic boxes.
Wow.
So everything is categorized alphabetically and chronologically.
Between 16,000 and 20,000 comics.
Yeah.
Is it a fire risk? Is it a fire risk?
No, I don't think so. Okay. Everything is regulated.
Yeah.
Even the humidity in the room is regulated. You have to, if they're collector's comics, some of them are relatively expensive.
Oh, so this is a serious endeavor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. I should take that surprise out of my voice.
Oh, not at all. Superman 1 from 1938 sold for $2.38 million.
Wow.
So, and Batman, the first appearance of Batman was in Detective Comics 27. And that's, you know, well over $1 million for a piece of paper, really.
And have you any idea, I won't give out your full address, but have you any idea the value of your thousands upon thousands of comics, all beautifully arranged and beautifully protected and packaged?
I wouldn't know a total amount, but I know some of those issues from 1940s are relatively expensive.
Okay.
They're in the thousands.
And Gareth, when you tell people about this, or I don't know if you do or not, like, surely people say, can I come and see the room?
Some do. Yeah. Others, it's a mixed reaction. Some people think, look at this man-child, he's a bit of a geek.
Well, that's no problem,
okay, I embrace my happy childhood, and little things like this make me happy. And others are met with genuine interest.
Yeah, and would you?
Wow.
Would you slip into the comic room every day and just have a browse, or I presume you have an armchair in there. You might go in if you're a bit, just want a change and sit down and.
I do, but I've got little kids, so I don't really find much time to get up there as much as I'd like.
And what do the children think of the room?
Oh, my son loves it. I'm trying to get him into comics too.
Brilliant.
But he's 8.
Well, you know, the Beano is now nearly 6 in Dublin. It'll cost you £6.590. You get 10 cent change. So expensive. They become so expensive. And I also noticed that the number of magazines in various stores seems to be, you know, there are some stores which have an incredible, fantastic collection of magazines, be they about buses or classic bikes or knitting or painting or embroidery or calligraphy. They seem to be diminishing in terms of the shelf space as well. Stay with us, Gareth. Where is Tina Dermody? Tina is in Kildare. Tina?
I'm in Blessington, actually.
Oh, are you very good? Are you snowed in?
No, okay. We were lucky.
Thank God, the estate
was, but we're okay. We got out now.
Great, okay. Now tell us, did you know the Beano was nearly €6 if you're to buy it for your child?
If you can tell me where it's €6, I'll go there, because the big retailer here in Blessington, in the magazine section, I pay over €7 for it.
For the Beano?
Mm-hmm.
If you go to Galway, we'll get it.
Well, I go because I have the free travel now, so it'll be well worth my while.
Okay.
And I'd have enough money for a cup of tea.
And do you buy the Beano? Is the Dandy still out there as well?
Yeah, but the Beano seems to be more prominent.
Yeah.
But why I buy it is I have a grandson in America.
Ah.
He's 11. And one day I just bought it for him, and he absolutely loves it. So I send it to him every so often. And I send the annuals then, that come out once a year.
Oh, I loved them, yeah.
And they're absolutely brilliant, Joe. And it's a different, like, I think if kids had them now, they'd love them.
They're a work of art, aren't they? The drawings,
absolutely.
As well as the
And
story.
They're a bit, like, they're much the same as they were, except they throw in skateboarding stories and mobile phone things.
Now, I think if you
could, like, years ago, I don't know, you know, what way people are now. But there was a great thing going around where we used to swap comics.
Oh, I loved it, yeah.
And there there was the Bunty.
Yeah.
But the first one I remember was the School Friend, and that had the four Marys in it.
Yeah.
Did
four Marys not defect to the Bunty at one stage?
Oh, maybe they did.
There was a bidding war. And they moved to the Bunty. And what comic did you... Okay, you got the School Friend, which was...
School Friend was the first.
Yeah.
We didn't get pocket money, obviously. It was the bad old days.
Yeah.
But my mother used to buy Woman's Weekly and Woman's Own, and she'd get me the comic. And then as time went on, the Bunty came out, and then the Judy. And they were great, too.
The Bunty,
but
yeah.
I think,
and the Mandy,
honest,
I loved
the
Mandy.
The older style comics were very, very good.
And what did you love about them?
Just there was always a story in it, and about the four Marys, and they were all, they kind of portrayed different kind of personalities. I mean, you didn't think of that as a kid, but there'd be the real straight-laced girl who was studying, and then there'd be the wild one, and you know, there
the
was
Derry,
all that
the
sort
four
of
Marys
stuff.
Were Derry girls in their own way back in the day.
Oh, they were. They were more respectable, I'd say, than the Derry girls.
But I tell you
because
something.
Because of the time.
Yeah.
I think they were boarders in a school.
Yeah,
but
they
were.
Yeah.
Stories.
But
you know,
but
they were,
Tina,
obviously they were.
Were they not all very British?
Like, that's what I was going to say. Of course they were British, but sure, we didn't care about that.
Yeah, okay.
That only
because
developed later.
What comic was Lord Snooty in? Remember Lord Snooty?
That was the Dandy.
The Dandy, okay.
I think, yeah.
And Desperate
and
Dan,
was,
who used to eat cowpies,
You know, the Tin Man and those kind of mad things, you know.
Yeah, and then I always loved the likes of Roger the Dodger. Now, Victor and the Hotspur were my favourites.
Yeah.
And Nasher. And you remember Dennis the Menace?
Dennis
the Menace and Goofy.
Do you know what, Joe? They were brilliant.
Yeah. Do you still have any of them?
No.
Apart from the ones you're buying.
God, no.
But
I'm a thrower out.
But isn't that fascinating that your grandchild in the United States, I don't know what part they're in, actually took to the Beano?
Oh, he loves it. And the annuals are brilliant. And funny enough, like the comic is over €7 here now, which I don't mind. I'm only saying.
Okay.
But the annual is actually very good value.
Yeah,
and a very good place to get them if people are interested. Sometimes in the second-hand shops like Vincent's and that here in Blassington. And they have them in perfect condition. You know, like you get them for £1.
Yeah. I still try and buy an annual once a year just for the feel of it and the smell of it.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
On Christmas Day.
The annuals they have now are gorgeous. And as I say, you can pick them up at the second-hand shop, but they're not that dear. And they're really nice. And, like, I think it's a great break for kids to read that sort of stuff, you know?
I was looking there again when I heard this was coming up. The Beano sold 2 million in the night. 2 million copies. Can you even imagine that on pallets?
Oh, I can.
2 million. And it's, do you know how many it sells now, Tina? And I'm including your one. It sells something like 37,000 copies a week. In the UK and Ireland.
For the production, though, maybe.
But,
you know?
But it's very low, isn't it? But anyway, it's still there.
Yeah, people should buy it for their kids. And it should get them off the blooming computers for a while like that.
Get
their reading up.
Yeah, buy one copy and leave it around.
The plots are kind of complicated. And it gets kids. And they have little puzzles and little bits and pieces like that in them, you know?
Okay, stay with us, Tina. Jean Farrell is in Athlone. Jean, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You love the Four Marys as well.
I did indeed. And Joe, I was a young child in the 1950s.
Okay.
And this is something perhaps modern people wouldn't realise at all.
Yeah.
We had nothing else to do. When you consider, after we did our lessons and we said the rosary, and we all sat in the room, what did we do?
Yes, and we loved
the
rosary.
The second oldest of 10 children. So every one of us got comics and we all absolutely loved them. And it was a marvellous way to if you didn't read, all you knew about the world was just what happened immediately on your own street. Whereas comics gave us an insight into how the rest of the world lived. And we loved reading them. For instance, we read about ballet classes and tutus in Sandra of the Secret Ballet and Myra Kent. And then in the Four Marys, we read about horse riding and gymkhanas and cross-country running and PE lessons.
Brilliant.
It's really broadened our minds a lot. And then I think it also gave us a love of reading, of the written word and storytelling. And we became marvellous readers afterwards, going to the library, etc. So we loved comics.
The stories were brilliant. And which comic and which characters were your favourite, Jane?
I got the Bunty and my sister Sheila got the Judy on a Wednesday. I loved Bunty and I loved the Four Marys. And I wonder, do the people remember Mary Field, Mary Raleigh, Mary Cotter and Mary Simpson?
The two
bullies then were Veronica and Mabel. And
the two bullies were who?
Veronica and Mabel.
That was my mother's name. Okay, the two bullies. So two bullies were Veronica and May, but I forgot there was bullies. I used to read every comic I could get including the Bunty, the Judy, the Mandy, the Jack, whatever else was going around. Now, you say many different comics came into your house each week, Jean.
Well, you see, when the boys were younger, they would have read Beano and Dandy and yes. Topper and Beezer. And then as they got older, they'd read the Victor and the Hotspur and the New Hotspur. And yeah. all of us read every single one of them, and we absolutely loved them. And we loved the annuals at Christmas. And Joe, something a lot of people will remember okay. are the cut-out dolls on the back of Bunting. We got endless yeah. value out of those.
We sure did. We sure did.
We used to cut them out and yeah. stick them onto cardboard, stick the body onto cardboard, and then have all the different dresses.
And
we used to have
nurses.
Our own collections
yeah, yeah.
in shoe boxes. Yeah.
Ah, they were incredible. Now, Jean, you've gone further, which is fantastic. You've written a play called The Six Marys.
I did. The Six Marys.
Speak freely.
People are... When I was a primary school teacher, Joe, and I retired in 2011, age 60,
okay.
and I always wanted to be a stand-up comedian, which I told nobody about,
okay.
and I kept notes of funny lines in a whole lot of different
okay.
copy books. And then when I retired, one weekend, I wrote a one-woman show that has two people in it called The Six Marys, which I have presented all around Ireland and in London, and it's been a marvellous success.
And what... Well, tell me the story. You come out on a stage, you're on your own.
I do. And I say... I'm reading a diary. I say that in my class in the national school, there were six girls called Mary. They were called Mary Green, Mary Brown, Mary White, Mary Black, Mary Grey and Mary Golden. And then I go on through the decades telling the various things that happened to us. And in my play, Mary Grey is grey and dull and boring, and Mary Golden is golden and mad and the girl we all wanted to be. And we follow life right through the diaries. And my other actress, Catherine Gallagher, sings. And we've been in, I've performed it 123 times now, which is wonderful, wonderful, in my old age, Joe.
And Jean, is it a true story about the Marys?
No, it's not really. Everyone said we actually did it in Bray Golf Club just before Christmas. And so many people said to us afterwards, it's the story of all our lives. And Joe, the theme is this. You go through life expecting your Mr. Wonderful and your children and everyone else to mm-hmm. make all your dreams come true. But eventually you realise you make your own dreams come true. That's the theme of it. It's universal.
And when you were a young child, did you tell your parents you wanted to be a comedian?
Well,
when you grew up and they'd laugh at you, but they're not laughing now.
No, I didn't know I wanted to be one until I was getting older. But it's lovely in my old age, Joe. I'm 73 to be doing this and I'm enjoying it very much. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners will have been to my play because thousands have seen it. In fact, one woman came to it seven times in the Mill Theatre in Dundrum. She enjoyed
it
so
incredible.
Much.
It's called The Six Marys.
The Six Marys.
And
yeah.
do you refer to the Bunty or the Judy in it?
I'm talking to you here, Joe, and in front of me I have a Bunty and a Judy comic. And do you know how much they are? 1963, it was 5D.
Five.
But it's the same currency in England and Ireland, I forget.
That's right, yeah, it was back in those days.
Yeah.
5D
is basically 2 cents. I bought them actually for €8 each online to have them. And during the play I refer to the fact that we read these comics, and every single night without exception when I hold them up a big sigh comes up from the audience of recognition.
Isn't that brilliant? Isn't that absolutely brilliant? When are you performing it next?
Whenever I'm asked. And it's been all over the place.
And what's the singing in it? Tell me how you bring...
My wonderful co-performer is called Catherine Gallagher, and she sings songs from the various eras which the audience love and acts them out. And as I say, everyone recognises it because when I talk about married life and about the husbands and about the children and the teenagers, I tell it as it is, which people really relate to.
OK, now, Jean, I don't know if you have grandchildren or whatever.
But have they
any interest in comics?
I was just thinking of this, Joe. Over Christmas, we were all sitting here in my sitting room, about six people, including four grandchildren, age 14 and younger. Every one of us, including myself, are looking at our screens. And I was just thinking back to the 1950s, with nothing else to do. The answer to that is, yes, in second-hand shops, like the last lady said, I always pick up annuals if I see them. And
brilliant.
The children love those
brilliant.
Old annuals. Yeah.
Don't they? And they're so sturdy and... Everything. Stay with us, Jean. Stay with us,
okay.
John. And I have more people who want to talk about comics. Oh, by the way, I vaguely knew this. Thin Lizzy, the most famous rock band in the 60s, 70s and 80s ever to come out of Ireland, was named after a character in The Dandy that Philip Lynott used to read. And the character was Thin Lizzy, T-I-N-L-I-Z-Z-Y, and Philip changed it to Thin Lizzy. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We were talking at the start of the programme about the price of comics being no laughing matter, but people have such fond memories of comics. Where Joan Grennan is above in Sligo. Joan.
You would, oh, yes, Joe, how are you? I am how are you? Here. Yes.
Come in to the parlour. Will you sit down?
I will indeed.
Do you want to? Will I put the kettle on?
Well, indeed.
Who was your favourite, Joan?
Oh, God, I have very vivid memories of comics from the 50s. I probably got the very first ones that came out, you know, Bunty and Judy and the Four Marys. I mean, they were more real to me than anyone, around me, to be honest. I can remember their names as clearly as yesterday. They were called Mary Simpson, Mary Cotter, Mary Riley, Mary Field. And the funny thing about it was, in my own family, I had three first cousins called Mary, and then there was myself. We made up four Marys. Now, I won't say the surnames because I wouldn't want to embarrass them, but sure enough, they're still hale and hearty and lovely people, lovely ladies, all of them. Yeah.
And do you say do you still have comics? Do you still collect them?
Not really, no. But in the background and the environment I lived in as a child, they really were a lifeline. You know, they were. It's hard to describe what rural Ireland and especially Mayo now in the '50s was like. Mm-hmm. I lived near a village in Mayo called Ballantyne. I would have bought the first Bunty and Judy and the first Smiths in Claremorris, which was the forerunner of all the Smiths.
Biggest tie company now in the world, Smiths.
That's right.
In the world.
I know. Yeah, I remember exactly where it started, and I was talking to my brother about it.
And that's where you bought your first comic. In
it
Smiths.
Would have been, definitely. Yeah. And the first Smiths, that's where I saw the first Barbie as well.
Wow.
Who was about 60 years old at least at this stage. Yeah, I remember her very clearly as well.
Incredible. And what you had a beautiful phrase there, Joan. You said the four Marys were closer to you. You knew, you felt you were closer to them than some of the people you actually knew.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. We existed as children in a very cold climate. And as a girl especially, you didn't feel there was much importance attached to you at all. Little throwaway remarks, made it very clear, I definitely thinking back to those days. To be honest now, Joe, I'll be honest with you, I don't feel so much nostalgia or fondness or anything. I just feel a lot of sadness in a lot of ways because females were definitely the children of a lesser god, everything about it. Even the comics reflected that in a way. The boys' ones now, which all your male listeners would have read, they were the Dandy and the Beano,
and
there
were Victor
and the Buster and other ones as well.
Yeah.
And they never attempted to get into the mindset or anything like that of their characters. They were basically young males and older ones too. They'd be a lot. There was Desperate Dan with his enormous chin and his big cow pie and all that kind of thing. They were kind of, just sort of humour and all that. And a lot of, just boys having fun and being giddy and bold and daft, like Dennis the Menace and all that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the girls, once you read, they had more inner life in them, you know what I mean?
That's a fascinating observation, Joan, which I had not.
But I don't know.
It comes from you so easily, obviously. But for me, your point there when you say that comics in the '50s, especially in rural Ireland, and especially for young women, and this was an era. I'm paraphrasing you now. Please check me. This was an era when young women and women generally were seen and not heard, and to read these comics and follow these female characters who had an exciting life and an inner life as well through their weekly stories was a revelation.
Oh, it was. It absolutely was, for sure and certain, I can't even begin to paint a picture of how bleak our environment was. You remember, you may well have known how the late wonderful Christina Murphy, she was an education correspondent.
Of course, Christina Murphy, yeah.
Yeah, she came from Castlebar, same part of the country as myself now. When she was asked about that era, she all she remembered was greyness, like no colour at all, clothes, everything. And there was so much differentiation between males and females. It was extraordinary. Yeah. It was in poems, it was in reading books, it was everywhere. These Buntings and Judys were the only escape from all of that indoctrination, they call it, you know?
Yeah, it almost sounds that they were almost subversive literature. Like, for example, could you bring your comics into school?
Well, I can't remember ever bringing them to school at all. Yeah. You know, my brothers might have swapped them in their school with each other, but I can't remember. No. Indeed, I doubt very much if the majority of the girls would have got them at all, you know. It was, my father was into reading, all right. Actually, more than the Bunty and the Judy, I was raised really on the Reader's Digest. My father used to get that every single month. And I just read everything in it. And around about the time, I'll give you a laugh now, around about the time I was reading the first Bunty, I also read in the Reader's Digest an article by a father, and the title of it was, I Saw My Son Being Born. And that would have been around about 1958. So from an early age, I was reading all sorts, inappropriate and everything.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And the Far East and the magazine for St. Martin de Porres, a lot of your older listeners.
It was,
they
were so important. But go back to the comic. Did you do the paper dolls? Jean Farrell was talking about the paper dolls that you cut out.
I absolutely adored the paper dolls. Okay. Now, I had no interest in dolls in general, but the paper dolls were more interesting. They had these little flaps on them and you changed them around and they were just great. Like, they were just a little... I would have been very creative, I suppose, really,
well
and
done.
Crafts and everything would have been fantastic for me. But we had nothing, no sports, no art, no crafts, just Irish droned in from morning to night. It was indescribable, it really was,
And Joan, just briefly, I'm mesmerised, when you went into Smith's, the original Smiths, it is Claire Morris, isn't it? Give me the.
It is, yeah.
When
there,
you went into, I know the there, shop is still there. We spoke to them, which has now become this incredibly, really well run multinational out of began in the shop in Claire Morris. When you went in and saw your first Barbie doll, can you remember?
Yeah, vividly, I can remember the first Barbie doll because, as I said, I wasn't really interested in dolls. I used to get an odd one in a person from America. Actually, the very first coloured person of any description I ever laid my eyes on, apart from Martin de Porres, who was a member, dark skinned person, was a doll from America. But Smiths used to do a great range of dolls. They certainly did. But Barbie was a different kettle of fish altogether. She was so long and thin. I was just saying to your researcher, they reckoned that Barbie would be 7 foot tall if she was reproduced as a real person.
Oh. Long, tall, and thin.
Yes, and then she had the breasts, and my aunt was with me, and we were looking at it, and she was tut-tutting and everything, and she thought it was a desperate thing altogether. There's no way.
Barbie had breasts.
Oh, yeah, Barbie,
Okay. Oh, John, that's fantastic, and Jean is fantastic, and I see the other callers. Mary Meehan from Ballyferm. Mary, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
I remember your shop, you see.
Dorans. Oh, but it's still there.
Oh, yes. Okay. Tell us. And you did our shop up in Claddagh Green with Boylan's. That's where we got our comics.
That's right.
And what are your memories of in your family shop?
Well, my parents used to, they would sell all the comics and magazines. My mother, we used to order the annuals about a year in advance. And we also had a list of names of people that would order all these magazines.
Yes.
And you'd have to write all the names down.
I remember that,
And they went into a special box until they came to collect their magazines and comics. But the Jackie was a big one. That used to have a poster in the middle of your pop stars.
Should I still have my Mark Bolan? Remember Mark Bolan? The pull-out poster, and it's to all Jackie readers. I still have it on my ceiling at home. The iconic Mark Bolan. Now, you say the shop is still going. Is there any demand for comics?
No, I'm afraid not. But I still sell the Ireland Zone and the RTE Guide. They're still demand for those two. All right.
Okay, well done, mm-hmm. Mary. That's Mary Mean. Where's Barbara? Thanks, Mary. And keep going.
You're welcome.
Barbara Bourke, Barbara.
Hello, Joe. Barbara here.
And you remember which comic especially?
Well, what I remember is particularly, I only came in a bit late to the show.
Okay. You're forgiven.
Yeah, I remember the Bunty so well. This is back in the early 60s.
Yeah.
But as I was saying to your researcher, I used to get the Bunty, and don't even remember reading anything in it. All I wanted was the back page for the cutout dolls. That was all I was interested in. But the funny thing was, what I looked forward to every summer when I was a child, all through primary school, my mother and I would have to go over to London because I had to check back. I had a medical condition and I had to go to the hospital in London. And the main thing, I wasn't worried about anything to do with the hospital, but we'd have our annual trip into Woolworths in London, where they had massive, big, I can still see them,
fantastic,
like double-sized kitchen tables. And they'd have, where you'd find the Bunty, you'd find dozens of all the older editions of the Bunty there.
Yeah.
And they'd sell all of them off cheap, apart from the up-to-date ones. So I would go home with rakes of them. It was wonderful. That was the special time, early 60s.
Yeah.
Aer Lingus planes, really glamorous, the hostesses.
Yeah.
You know, it
and
was
glamorous, Joan and indeed Jean referred to. Glamour in an otherwise very dull and insular and insulated and indeed protected world, especially for young women. Very well put. Thanks, Barbara. Thanks, Joan. Thanks, Jean. Keep in touch. joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And joe@rt.ie at 5:30 this afternoon, 73 years ago, an Aer Lingus plane. Aer Lingus mentioned the glamour of it just before the break. An Aer Lingus plane took off from Northolt Airport, which is now RAF Northolt, just north of London, on a trip back to Dublin. It was due in Dublin about 8 o'clock. And at 10 past 7, the plane disappeared over Snowdonia. And all 23 people on board were lost, and we spoke about them in detail 2 days ago, and were contacted, as you know, by a number, not just of survivors, of the relatives of the deceased, but also Aer Lingus staff, one of whom was due to be on that plane, which invariably always happens, doesn't it? And she spoke so movingly about her fellow Aer Lingus staff who ran it. This is the news report. Now, remember, it's from 1952, and it's a great P.P. O'Reilly, but this is how RTE covered it both. Now, obviously, there would have been much more than this, but there was very few news bulletins on RTE in those days, and no talk radio programmes of any description, so to speak. It was primarily music. But this is a short clip of how this awful tragedy was covered 73 years ago.
An airliner on the Dublin to London service is reported to have crashed tonight in Wales.
The air had taken its toll.
The next morning it was clear that the nation was stirred by the tragedy. It seemed a personal loss to all.
In Wales, later that day, I went to a shepherd's cottage high in the mountains of Snowdonia. There I met Mr. and Mrs. Bronwyn Williams.
Well, I was standing in the door emptying the teapots when this plane came sweeping down twice, I think, and made such a noise that I called my husband, and then he came to the door.
What did you see or hear then, Mr. Williams?
I heard the plane flying very low over the house. It came twice, and I saw a glow in the sky.
The Court of Inquiry attached no blame to anybody.
Now, the interesting thing is that plane that Mr. Williams talked about coming twice over low over their house and obviously then crashed into the bog. The weather was atrocious and the communications and navigation is not at all what it is today. But that plane is still in that bog. And this is one of the reasons why we were contacted by relatives, that as the world moves on, it's 72 years later, 73 years later, as the world moves on and the climate moves on and the world, the plane is gradually, the wreckage of the plane, obviously is spread out, is gradually rising out of the bog. And as one woman, one relative told us, she had an incredible phrase, that the bog is giving up what does not belong there. So they're asking for the wreckage of the plane to be, because there's still some bodies that were never recovered, to be brought back to Ireland. Now, Maureen Brown is in Churchtown in Dublin. Maureen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And you were working in Aer Lingus at the time, Maureen.
I was, and I came in on a flight from London, I think, I'm not sure. And when I arrived at the airport, about 8 o'clock, I suppose, or before, and I asked, we got a crew car driver when we were late. So anyway, I asked him to bring me home because I was due out early the next morning at the airport. So he did that, and I went home and had my sleep and woke up to hear my mother saying, don't go out there. And I said, so I had to reassure her I was fine, I was going. So out I went to the airport in the crew car, and Miss Blake, who was the supervisor of the air hostesses, was sitting there at a table, and I went into her, and she said, I'd asked the crew car driver, was it true, this bad news? And she said to me, what do you think? Do you wish to abandon the flight that you're scheduled for? And I said, no, I'll go. Because if I don't go now, I'll never go.
Wow.
And I went on the flight. Now, I have a feeling it might have been to Paris. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It seems a bit early in the morning to be going to Paris. But anyway, I'm not sure. And I knew then that the flight had crashed belonging to Aer Lingus. Yeah. And everybody was very stunned because they didn't expect this thing to happen. And that was it. I went on a flight that day. Now, again, as I say, I'm not sure where I went. But anyway, from my point of view, I had to continue working. And that was the end of it. I had to put it at the back of my mind. And I did until I became ill later on. And that was it. I stopped flying. I continued with Aer Lingus until 1955, in which I got married. So that's, I know that I was there that night before when it hadn't arrived, and I was there the next morning early. So that's it.
And Maureen, did you know Deirdre Sutton, who perished?
Yes, I did. She wasn't in my group. In my group was Maura McLeish.
Yes, who we heard.
And I was delighted to hear her because she was, 20 of us went in when I went in. And it would have been the February of 51. And I was 22 in the May of that year.
Okay.
And so I was there for that length of time. Now until 55 when I got married. And I have no recollection of any accident Before that, it was completely out of the blue.
Yes.
And then it seemed to haunt me afterwards because I worked in a boutique after I was married, and it happened to be Derbyshire's son's old home.
Ah.
And yes.
In Ranelagh,
and
Dublin, I knew
I got to know Maurice Dempsey very well, because when I got married first, I lived in Bray, and Maurice, they were the butchers.
Okay.
And at this stage, he was married to a girl, another girl who had been apparently on some part south of Aer Lingus, and they had a child.
Okay.
And I knew Maurice, I would meet him one day after the other. And after some time, then we went out with them one night, I remember. And it just, I didn't ask him anything about it. And I appreciated that it must have felt terrible to him.
Yeah.
You know, however, and, that's really it.
And Maureen,
I
did,
just kept on. Yes?
Sorry for a question. Did you fly on the DC-3, on the Dakotas?
Yes,
and
of course.
And what were they like? Were they...
They were fine.
Oh, okay.
You had 28 passengers.
Right.
And then I flew on the Wayfarers. Now, they were the end, because they were big, bulky aircraft that the baggage seemed to be into the front of the aircraft.
Okay.
And they had 24 seats, I think, and noisy and cold everything that you wouldn't expect.
That's incredible. So, stay there for a moment. These are incredible memories, Maureen, of somebody who was
a good memory.
Yes, you have. Stay with us, Maureen Brown. Michael McLaughlin was a pilot in Aer Lingus. You never flew the DC-3s, Michael.
Not at all.
Yep. Go ahead, Michael. You never flew the...
Good afternoon, Joe. No, I didn't. I joined much... much later after the DCTs had all been retired.
And there was many of them, wasn't there, after the war in commercial service?
Oh, yeah, there was a large number. There were about 16,000 built altogether.
Wow.
And interestingly, there are about 100, at the last count that I was aware of, there are about 160 flying in various parts of the world even now. For an aircraft that was...
That's incredible.
First went into service in 1936 in the US with Continental Airlines.
Now, the problem that night seemed to be, would you explain the navigation system such as it was from your research, Michael, at that time?
Well, aviation, while it wasn't in its infancy, it was probably in its early teens compared to the very mature industry it is now. And the equipment that pilots would have depended on was very rudimentary. On a flight from Dublin to London, for instance, you'd be depending on what were called NDBs, non-directional beacons, which were medium wave transmitters, just exactly the same as the radio transmitter that Radio Éireann would have had in Athlone. And you could track towards that. You could, a needle would... You tuned it in using a thing just like the circular knob on a radio until you got the correct signal. Now, of course, it wasn't giving out a broadcast like a commercial radio station. You identified it when you got the correct Morse code identifier on it.
Okay.
And you were listening to that. I mean, there were a number of them around Dublin even. There was one in Killiney. There was one in Rush. So you tuned this in.
Okay.
In the same way as you tuned in a normal radio, and then you heard, you knew you were, your needle was pointing in the right direction when you got the correct Morse code identifier.
Incredible,
on.
Yeah. Extraordinarily basic, Michael.
Yeah, and you used that in combination with a compass to make sure that you were flying towards that beacon on the right track. And then you might have waypoints which were... simply points in space where a particular track from two different beacons intersected with each other. But it was quite basic, and it was
well we know from listening to the radio and medium wave there would be interference. Was there were those beacons, those radio beacons, which were so vital to get me from A to B in the right direction, could they be interfered with by weather or whatever?
Oh, indeed, it was a big problem in very bad weather, because a thunderstorm which produces electricity would cause the needle to deflect, and rather than pointing towards the correct station, it would actually point towards the thunderstorm. And, it could actually be very difficult to get a reliable signal in bad weather, which, of course, is the time when you need it.
Yeah, mostly. Yeah.
And, the DC-3 as well was an unpressurized aircraft, and aircraft nowadays, or from, say, the 1960s onwards, would be pressurized, have jet engines, and were able to fly above the weather. But DC-3s, unfortunately, wouldn't fly above maybe 7,000 or 8,000 feet. And as a result, they were forced to fly if they were in bad weather. They were right in the area where the worst of the weather was. Which would be a serious problem. And on the night in question, I understand that the weather was particularly bad.
Yeah. Well, as I say, it's this day, 73 years ago, and we know what the weather's been like even here over the last few days. There were 16,000 of these craft manufactured, Michael. Were they prone? Were they prone to crashing, or was it just... Now, again, the systems are so rudimentary.
No. When they were introduced first, they were an enormous step forward.
And, okay.
You know, by the outbreak of the wars, they were the most popular and common aircraft in the world. They were a huge step forward.
Yeah.
To put it into perspective, when it was first introduced, it enabled people to fly from New York to San Francisco or Los Angeles in 18 hours with only three stops along the way.
Okay.
And that was considered a great thing at that time.
Of course, yeah.
And, but now we would consider it an enormous odyssey of a journey to spend 18 hours getting from one side of the U.S.
Okay.
But it wasn't. It was just aviation at the time developing and learning. And people's knowledge of meteorology and weather phenomena was not what it is now, and even the physics that were involved.
Yeah,
most people in Ireland will be familiar with the accident which occurred in Munich in 1958,
in which United,
the Manchester United football team were involved. Now, you know, that aircraft made several attempts to take off, and because of the slush and water and that melted snow that was on the runway, it was never going to be able to reach the speed that it required to be able to take off or lift off from the ground. But nobody knew about that at the time. It was only after the accident that experiments were done to find that the wave of liquid that built up in front of the wheels actually acted like a brake and prevented it accelerating sufficiently. But there were new knowledge like this was being found out as a result of accidents. Remember also that human beings had only been getting off the ground powered flight for less than 50 years at this stage.
Yes, well contextualised, very well contextualised. And Michael, I'm conscious, I know you were in Aer Lingus long after that, but you are an Aer Lingus veteran, so you're the only person I've been speaking to for Aer Lingus today. So condolences to, so to speak, your predecessors. Three Aer Lingus crew were killed in that day. That's Michael McLaughlin. Thank you indeed, Michael. Michael, stay listening to Rory Dicker. Rory is in Kilkenny, but you have a remarkable connection. Go ahead, Rory.
Joe, you and I would have met in Harvey's Point a few summers ago, and I shared another little story with you, but that's another for another day. But anyway, I was a farm student for a man called William Williams, who was a lay Methodist preacher, amongst other things. And I was there for 12 months. And on a summer's day, he took me up.
So you were near the crash site?
I worked on a farm called Haverdrisg, which I think is a summer farm in the hills or something in Welsh. But anyway, he was a big sheep farmer, and he took me up there and told me the story of the night the plane crashed and how he remembers going up with his father on the night, but a torchlight. They couldn't get any helicopters, anything. Yeah. You know, it's a really precipitous and high part of Snowdonia. And he remembers picking up, I think it was a child's shoe, and handing it to someone.
That was Melody's shoe.
Yes, and I remember that the actual crash site is literally a bog. You couldn't really walk into it at all. And there were parts of the plane sticking out, which I imagine that is still the situation. I don't know. I haven't been following the discussion.
And that is, in one sense, where the discussion began. The plane is becoming more and more prominent in the bog and Rory people. And the shoe that was, and our little baby doll, the shoe that was collected, was found, was subsequently identified as the shoe of Melody Laker. I think it was only her parents were killed in as well.
But it's a sort of living, it's a living graveyard. I have to say, I was deeply moved. I was only in I think I was 17 or 18 at the time. Okay. But I was deeply moved by the whole
remarkable
experience.
Remarkable connection. Thanks, Rory. Thanks, Maureen.
For
thanks, Michael. And God rest all those who perished on this day. Joe at rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Back to comics. Rosemary Sweeney is in Donegal, but Rosemary have a fascinating connection with the Beano comic. Tell us, Rosemary.
Hi, Bob. Joe, sorry. No, I lived in London in the 70s, in the middle 70s.
Okay.
On Chalk Farm. And the flat above me was rented out by a guy called Bob Hodgson.
Okay.
And he actually drew the characters from the Beano, the Dandy, and a magazine called The Viz, which was
I remember
Viz, comics.
Yeah,
and he hand drew the characters. You know, he'd come in the morning at 9 o'clock and work all day. And it's just amazing to think about it now, because I'm sure they're all computer generated these days. I don't know, but he worked. You know, it was his job.
Yeah. Did you see his work when you went up to his flat?
Yes. He worked on the point for
Your line is fading on me there. But I just wonder, I presume all that original artwork must be somewhere. It must be valuable.
Must be.
It's beautiful. Beautiful. Rosemary, you've got me on to the next caller called Declan Shalvey. Declan, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
How are you keeping? You do. It is still alive and well, and it is still a craft and a profession and an incredible skill, and that is drawing for comics, because that's what you do and you write as well.
Yeah. Well, I started out drawing, I broke in at Marvel there over a decade ago.
Okay.
And started writing since, but yeah, I mean, it's all still hand drawn.
Wow.
So, you know, there'll be a lot of people who would work digitally, as in they would draw on tablets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But personally, myself, I still draw on paper. I'm drowning in pages right now.
And tell us how you got into this. It's fascinating.
Well, I would have, you know, this was before the internet and everything.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, comics were a way of reading stories, all different types of stories from all over wherever. I think some people kind of confuse comics with like a specific thing. There's actually stories, there's superheroes, there's action, there's romance. It's a genre, it's a medium, not a genre, you know. So I would have gotten into the superhero stuff as a kid, and then in my teens I would have gotten into more like, you know, adult themed and horror, sci-fi stuff like that. But I just kept drawing and worked up a portfolio after college and went to conventions in the UK and the States. And eventually, you know, hopefully you get good enough for people that will pay you first.
And that's how you broke and Marvel and tell us you're currently working on the last issue of Mystique from the X-Men.
Yeah, that's right. Marvel. So I'd write and draw some different projects, but I don't know. I'd be more known in the last few years where there was a Disney Plus show called Moon Knight, one of the Marvel shows, and I designed a character that they used in that, the version of him and Reason, even the suit. So that's kind of what I'm most known for. But in the last year, yeah, I've been, if anyone knows the X-Men, Mystique is like the villain. Recognize her in the movies. She's all blue. But yeah, I've just been writing a spy series, sorry, writing and drawing. So it's all, I just finished it there on Monday. So I finally have a day off.
And do you write and draw at the same time? Do you follow me? Is that a stupid question?
Yeah, it's a process, you know. You'll pitch the whole story that will get, you know, you'll work with an editor to kind of break it down into issues, like you'll read single issues. So then, you know, I'd write that single issue, then I'll draw it and then I'll ink it and then that'll be sent to a colorist. And while the colorist is coloring that issue, I'll be writing the next one. So it's, you know, you're always juggling two or three different things at the same time, you know. So it's very work intensive, I have to say. But it's very satisfying, you know. You just have an idea. You can make it real.
What a craft. And Declan, what happens to your original art? Who owns it?
I own it. And years and years ago, the companies would have owned it.
Okay.
So you wouldn't have any rights to whatever you draw. Yeah. But that all changed, I think, in the 60s, 70s. There were some artists who kind of pushed to own their own work.
Brilliant.
So technically, companies own, you know, like if I draw a Spider-Man cover and they do a poster or whatever, they own the poster, as in the original character and the art used. But the original art, I could say, sell that to you, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're interested. No, I'm just kidding. You own all the original art now, but for a long time ago, that used to not be the case.
And Declan, now you're obviously much younger than me, for example, by the sound of you, but did the likes of the Beano and the Hotspur, they predated you, I presume?
No, I don't know. I mean, I'm 42, so like, you know, they would have been on the newsstands. So I would have read them as a kid now, but I think I don't remember them. I remember them, but I don't remember reading them too much. I think once I hit like 12 or 13, I got into all the superheroes, and that probably overrode whatever little brain power I had at the time. But no, I remember Tintin and Asterix and stuff like that. A lot. They were really good for being in libraries at the time.
That's incredible. Are you? I know we've a fantastic animation industry here. Between Kilkenny and Brown Bag and Bear and Dublin as well. So is there many like you, so to speak, Declan, drawing specifically for our comics?
There's loads.
Brilliant.
It's something I wish there was no more people knew more about. Like there's, I would say off the top of my head, maybe 20 people working at Marvel from Ireland.
Fantastic.
And that's not including creator-owned stuff. People just doing their own original material. There's loads. It's just we don't get the same kind of attention as say theatre or film and stuff like that. But there's actually a brilliant comic book. What's the word I'm looking for? Like not community, but like there's loads of professionals working in the country making comics, but we're kind of invisible.
It's such a skill.
It's a lot of hard graft too. Like
I can't imagine.
You know, every single thing on a page. If I was to draw a scene happening in your studio, I'd need to be able to draw people, the desks, the machinery. Mm. You know, like you need to kind of learn how to draw everything on the day you're drawing it. So it's a lot of hard graft, but it's not like say film where you need millions and millions to make something. You can just sit down with a piece of paper and a scanner and, you know, just like tell a story. It's very satisfying.
And I'm thinking of Cartoon Saloon, obviously, and Brown. They're just incredible. Even the nominations, the international recognition they get. By the way, piece of information, Declan, on the day that's in it. Apparently, it's gone now off my screen. Today, in 1929, Declan, long before, I'd say, even your parents saw the light of day, Tintin was first published today in 1929 in the Belgian newspaper. Tintin.
Oh, 1929, bloody hell.
There you are. And Tintin and his dog called? Little fella.
Snowy.
Well done. Declan, you've won the just a minute quiz on Lifeline as well. Well done.
Finally.
Tintin and his dog. I wouldn't have had a clue. Is that well done, Declan. Keep going. God.
Oh, thanks very much, Joe. Appreciate
and
it.
And is it a lonely job?
Yeah, it is. Okay. I mean, there are some people who will kind of get studios together.
Yeah.
But like I work on my own. Like I remember when COVID happened. You know, everybody had to start doing what I was used to doing.
Yeah,
which
is on their own.
Be on your own. But if you're okay in your own company, you're fine. But I'd have like, you know, like WhatsApp group with like other Irish lads who are doing comics. So,
yeah.
You know, you'll have a bit of a chat. But, you know, ultimately it takes so much work to do. You can't really be dossing, chatting away all day either, you know. So it depends on your temperament, but
do you get a fright?
It keeps me dancing around.
Do you get a fright when you see the first white sheet in front of you of a morning?
You know what? No, because I've just doing it so long now that I don't think, if I thought about it, yes, you kind of have to. You have to have a few mental tricks to kind of stop yourself from falling down that hole. You know.
Okay. Well done, Declan, and keep going and keep the creativity going in so many levels between the writing and the drawing or the creating these incredible images. That's Declan Shalvey. Thanks, Declan. Happy New Year to you and many more years of creativity. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715
815. The number of people who want to talk about comics and their memories. Ono, I won't get to everyone first. Ono Sullivan is in Timahoe and Laois. You collect comics.
Good afternoon, Joe. Yeah, I do indeed. Comics from the 60s, 50s, 60s and 70s, mostly to be the Dandy, the Beano. And Victor, I'd comics called The Wizard, Valiant. And of course, my favourite one was the Tiger and Jag, Tiger and Scorcher, because it amalgamated with other comics as the years went on from the 70s, from the 70s onwards.
And what did you love about comics?
I loved the art would be my main part of it. I loved the art in it. There was one character, Black Bob, the Wonder Dog in the Dandy.
Ah, yes.
And to a guy called Jack Prout was the artist, and he lived in the Scottish Highlands, and his artwork was just amazing. So I have all his books that there was eight Black Bob annuals issued between the 50s and 60s, and looking up, I got them all. So
okay.
They're my favourites, probably.
And I see, I'm out of time, but I see Owen's incredible stories coming up on the screen of people waiting for the bus to arrive on a Tuesday morning with the comics from Dublin or whatever. Incredible memories. Thanks indeed, Owen O'Sullivan. On sound, Paul Mernock, broadcast coordinator Shane Galvin, Rachel Graham, series producer Annette Egan. And Ray Darcy is next. And on Sunday, on The Meaning of Life, which is on at 10:30 after Dermot, the wonderful Mary McAvoy. There's nostalgia on the one hand, but as people know, she's developed into a fantastic writer and a very, very, very wise person, as I think you'll discover on Sunday night at 10:30 on RTE Radio 1 TV.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. For fabulous ideas and great savings, the winter sale is not to be missed. Now on, in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.